The period of time that we're discussing now, the period of the kingdoms of Judah and of Israel, the division of the Jewish people into two separate sovereignties, requires that we examine an institution, so to speak, in the midst of Klal Yisrael, amidst the Jewish people, which was, though not unique to the Jewish people, but which gave it an aura, it gave it a purpose. It really was one of the most influential groups of people that the Jewish people ever possessed. And I'm talking, therefore, tonight about the Nevi'im, about the prophets of Israel. As one of the boys in the yeshiva today so inelegantly phrased it to me, he says, Rebbe, are you going to tell them the bottom line about the prophets? Different kind of prophets. The fundamental viewpoint of prophecy amongst the Jewish people differs from what is the popular notion. The popular notion of a prophet is someone who can foretell the future. Well, that's true, because that's one of the tests of prophecy. The Torah itself lists it as being one of the tests, that if a false prophet, how does one know that somebody that represents himself as a prophet is a false prophet? So the Chumash tells us because of the fact that he has represented himself as a prophet and he has predicted that a certain event will occur or not occur, and then when the time comes, so if the event occurs or doesn't occur, if it's in line with his prediction, then he's still in the running to be a prophet. If, however, what he says does not occur, so then his claim to prophecy is damaged materially. Well, that's how we think of a prophet. We think of a prophet in terms of a pundit, really, in terms of somebody that can foresee the future, make accurate predictions, tell us what's going to happen. And we like those kind of prophets. Because of the uncertainty of human life, and because of the fact that all of us deep down in our hearts have no security regarding tomorrow, and we don't know what that will bring, we always find it refreshing that somebody has the nerve to tell us what tomorrow will bring. And because of that, we invest in that person a great deal of belief, even though that person may not be more expert than we are, and even though that person many times, if not most of the time, is absolutely inaccurate regarding his prediction. But the fact that he's a predictor gives him an audience. That's one of the great phenomena of all society, and certainly of Western society. We like to read political predictions, economic predictions, sports predictions, all sorts of predictions. Even though, just like the weather forecaster, a great deal of the time the predictions never come to pass. And many times they are just so far removed from what actually is going to come to pass that one would think that the person who predicted it should be embarrassed. But he or she never is. I see Gene Dixon makes predictions every year all over again, right? And the reason for that is that people like to have predictions made. People feel good about it. It restores our confidence that somehow it is a stable world and we're able to predict what's going to happen. That understanding of the prophets is a very shallow understanding. That's not the main task of the prophets. You should not misunderstand me. The prophets were predictors. And in fact, they foretold the ancient world, the modern world, the world to come yet. All of that is part of that prophecy. But that's like describing, the Mona Lisa as being a drawing. It's accurate, it's true, but that's not what it is. So, Lahavdil, we can say the same thing regarding prophets. Now, the first thing we should know, we make a brocha every Shabbos or every time we read the Haftorah, And the Haftorah is always taken from Nevi'im, from the words of the prophets. We make a brocha asher bochar b'nevi'im tovim, that God chose good prophets. What do we mean, good prophets? That they were role models. They were good people. We don't have a prophet who is a villain. We don't have a prophet whom I would not wish to identify with. And that is the basic lesson, the first basic lesson that the prophets came to teach us. That in order to be a leader of the people, in order to be worthy of Jewish trust at least, then the person has to be a good person. We don't want to entrust our belief in someone who is not a good person, no matter how accurate, no matter how great a genius he is, no matter how charismatic he is. If he's not a good person, he's not for us. And our rabbis make that sharp contradistinction between the prophets of the Jewish people and the prophets of the non-Jewish world. The non-Jewish world had a prophet, Bilam, who in prophecy, our rabbis say, matched Moses in certain areas. But Bilam is not a hero. He's far from it. He's a terrible villain because he's a bad person. He's just an evil person. So then we have a theological question. Why does God invest prophecy in people who are evil? I don't presume to speak for God. I don't know. But that's not my problem. But my recognition of the fact that the prophets of Israel, the prophets whom we are going to deal with, are good people, that's central to this entire issue. That's central to understanding their role. They were beyond reproach. They were unassailable people. Morally unassailable people. Well, once a person reaches that level, once he is able to reach that height, so then he has a different dimension, a different stature. And that brings us to the second thing regarding prophecy. The prophets fulfilled a public role during the time of the kings. We're talking about a time of divine right of kings. We're talking about a time when the king could do no wrong. Or if he did something wrong, there was no one there to tell him that he did it wrong. And if you told it to him, you did so at great peril. There are people who are, even today, there are very autocratic people who are unable to hear criticism, who are unable to hear a dissenting opinion. And one of the great problems of any leader of a political state or of an organization, etc., is that he is usually surrounded by yes-men, by sycophants. Isn't that a great idea? Oh, yes, right? We're all going to do it because the boss wants it done. That's how you get the Etzel produced. That's how the Challenger blows up. That's how the Iran scandal and Watergate and all the other debacles occur. Because somebody doesn't get up and say, the king is naked. What is wrong with you? How can we embark on such a foolish thing? But because the authority of the person that leads is so absolute, so then he is not subject to criticism. And among the Jewish people, that's lessened a little than perhaps, because the Jewish people are not very good followers. Hubris, it's hard to maintain it if you're the leader of the Jewish people. It's just very, they take it out of you. I'm always reminded of the poor Moshe Dayan's tomatoes. He is the man in 90, when he went, he was the Minister of Agriculture in 1955, not the Minister of War, but the Minister of Agriculture. And at that time, there were no tomatoes being produced in Israel. So he introduced tomatoes as a crop, as a cash crop. And the first year the tomatoes came in, they were between the size of a raisin and perhaps, you know, an M&M. That's how the tomato, and they were hard as rocks. So the Jewish people, in their generosity, called them Meshalach. Well, so if you have a people like that, right, so then it's harder to maintain the facade that you're always right. because you have a few million people that tell you how wrong you are. I think it's true in the rabbinate also. It's a very healthy thing. All rabbis are perfect, but we would believe so if it were not for the Balabatim. It's a healthy thing. It limits people. But the king, who's going to limit the king? Especially when the king is the anointed one of God, we're not only talking about a king. It's not Henry VIII here. You're talking about Shaul, David, Shlomo. You're talking about kings. Kings who themselves have divine spirit, who are themselves authors of the books of the Bible, who are on a moral plane also that is very, very difficult to attain. Who tells them that they made a mistake? Who is the one that is the counterbalance to that? And the answer to that is the prophets, the Nevi'im. One of the great tasks of the prophets, and I would say that Chazal tell us that after the first Beis HaMikdash there were no more prophets, the second Beis HaMikdash had no prophets. There are many interpretations for them, but I'm not second guessing God, but I'm merely saying a practical, there was no necessity for them. Because in the Second Temple you had no kings, really kings of stature. You didn't have the divine right of kings. You didn't have the house of David ruling. And therefore, the necessity to have such a type of a break on the headlong travels of the king, it just wasn't present. But in the First Temple, it was impossible without the prophets. And they are the key to the entire story. We meet, for instance, the two prophets in the time of David, Noson Hanovi and God HaChoze. So, again, we have to understand there are books of prophecy that we have. Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Yecheskel, the 12 minor prophets, so to speak, Treyoser. There are books of prophecy that we have. But there were hundreds, thousands of other people who were prophets that didn't leave over books, but who served the role of being a prophet. Where were prophets trained? There was a yeshiva for prophets. They were called the Bnei HaNevi'im, the sons of the prophet. Son here meaning not in a biological sense, but in a disciple. And there were a cadre of people who dedicated themselves to the service of the great prophets and who studied with them and who hoped through their own personal self-perfection to attain a level where the spirit of prophecy would come upon them as well. Many of them were successful. Most were not successful. Because the ultimate choice of who would be a prophet or not was God's. It was not like earning a degree or passing a course or taking a test. But these institutions existed. And people who studied for the prophecy were recognizable amongst the Jewish people. And that itself set one at a higher level. It was a holy caste. The Talmud mentions in one place, Mamleches Kohanim, the Jewish people, were supposed to be a kingdom of priests. So Mamleches Kohanim, Elu Bnei Aaron. Those are the sons of Aaron who achieved the priestly vocation, and the Levites. The Goy Kodosh and the holy people, who was the holy people? Elo HaNevi'im. They were the prophets of Israel. They were the examples of a holy man. So our example of a holy man, I tell you today, holy man, you think of Mahatma Gandhi. Don't tell me you don't. Richard Attleboro did that for him. You don't think of him as a wily manipulator, a political animal, you don't, in fact, if you say all of those things, it's not nice. It's almost sacrilegious. He's a holy man. Why is he a holy man? Because he walked around in a white sheet and he drank fruit juice. He also slept with 13-year-old girls. But that's the Western approach to a holy man. A holy man is somebody, you know, that he has nothing to do with life. You want to be a holy man, you know, retire to the monastery. That's not the Jewish concept. The prophets were not people who retired from life. The prophets all worked for a living, and we find them in very menial occupations. Shepherds and shoemakers. We find them plowsmen in the field. They are not people who are removed from life. They are people who have the problems of life. And we find them with parents, and with wives, and with children, with family, with difficulties. And they are holy men, because that was their personality, that was their opinion of life. They look to sanctify life and to bring that sanctification to others. But above all, as I'm telling you this second point, they were the conscience of the Jewish people. If you had a moral problem, that's part of the problem we have today. If a person has a moral problem, who does he ask? If he asks his lawyer, and I'm a lawyer, you don't very often get a moral answer. He's not paid to give you a moral answer. He tells you the legal situation, right? I've got this guy by the throat. We can take him over to Kohl's. Or you're in terrible shape. Let's plea bargain, or let's give in. Or, I'll make a deal for you. The lawyer answers in practical terms as he has to. But you don't go to him for moral advice. There are very few people in our society you go to for moral advice. The psychologist, the psychiatrist will not deal in morals. In fact, most of the time they deal in immorals. They tell you what's good for you, right? Which what they think is good for you. And it's true in every facet of life. And I don't want to talk about the clergy, but the clergy can also be found wanting. It's hard to get a moral answer. And there are certain problems that are so difficult that there are no answers to them. And then there are national problems that have no moral answer. What shall the state of Israel do now? Not what should it have done 40 years ago. What shall it do now, today? Given the situation that we're in, can't change situations. What is the moral answer? We have no one to ask because there are no prophets. A prophet is not because he'll predict how you're going to get out of the problem. That's not the problem. The prophet will give you the moral answer. And we find that great revelation to us in the story of David himself, in the story of David HaMelech, with the famous story with Bathsheba. So the Talmud tells us unequivocally that Kol mi she'omer she'David choto eino ela toeh. Whoever says that King David sinned makes a mistake. Legally, there is no sin. She was a divorced woman. He had a right to live with her, or he didn't transgress with living with her. And he was the king, he had certain privileges, etc., etc., etc. There are no errors. He didn't do anything wrong. But on a moral scale, he did something wrong. He was the king, not David, not the man that wrote Tehillim, not the king of Israel, not the man that wanted to build a base. We're not going to let you. And the prophet comes to him. So none of his advisors tell him. The chief of the Sanhedrin doesn't tell him. He had great Talmidei Chachomim around him. You know, there were great Rosh Yeshiva. There were great people around that should have told him, you know, David was not nice. Nobody told him anything. And he convinced himself, as all of us convince ourselves, only the Tanakh tells the story in such a way. But in Tanakh, we have no perfect people. We have only human beings. Our heroes are human beings. That's why we have a relationship to them. One of my great criticisms, I always mention to you about current biographies of great Jews, is that they make them perfect people. The moment you make them a perfect person, he has no relevance to me whatsoever. You know, he was 7 years old, he knew Shas, he was 15, he was a member of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, and he was a great man, he never did anything wrong in all of his life, nothing. Never got angry, never perfect. That biography does not interest me. It has no relevance to me. David HaMelech interests me. In my own peculiar arrogance, I feel a kinship to him. Many times I study Tanakh every day. I teach Tehillim in the yeshiva. You know, I feel him. I feel his pain. I feel his humanity. The Tanakh describes him as he is. So then you can appreciate how great he is. That's why he lasted 3,000 years. He got the longest running show on Broadway, David HaMelech. They're still singing his songs. Why? Because he's got that humanity in him. So the prophet comes to him and he tells him a story. He says, you know, I got a good case. You got a minute for me, Dave? Let's say I got a good case to tell you. And he tells him a whole story about a rich man with a sheep and a poor man with a sheep and everything. And David, before he realizes, he says, the man that did that should die. He stole the poor man's sheep. What a terrible thing. It's not legally wrong, David says. It's morally wrong. How could he have done it? And the prophet says, Atohu Osoish, you're the man. Four words in the Tanakh. Changes all the human history. David sees it. He doesn't say, take the guy out and hang him. He's eternally grateful to him. He saved him. He saved him in this world and in the next. Because he told him, on a moral plane, what was missing. And David, in his greatness, is able to deal with it. He's able to repent. He's able to pay the price. That's what makes him the king of Israel. And the prophets were always the moral conscience. Chazal tell us that the prophet Shmuel, when he comes to Shaul and he takes the kingdom away from him, so the Talmud tells us that the prophet Shmuel was very much frightened of Shaul. Shaul was, as we have seen, a person of moods. And when he was in a melancholy mood, he lost control of himself. He was a person of violence. And Shmuel was afraid. But he overcomes his fear in order to be the prophet. That's the job of the prophet. Achav meets Elio Anovi on the road. He's been looking for him. And he says to him, Ahatozeh Ocher Yisrael, is that you, the man that has polluted and destroyed the Jewish people? What does Elio answer him? Old blood and guts, Elio. He says, Lo Acharti, not me, buddy. You're looking in the mirror. You and your family and your father's house, you've destroyed it. If you see destruction, don't look at me. Look at yourself. Nobody ever said that to Achav. Achav also does tshuva. The Talmud in Sanhedrin says that Achav, and we'll discuss Achav at length in the next lecture, but the Talmud itself says that Achav is in the world to come, he's excluded. But in this world he did tshuva. Achav, Elio touched him. How did he touch him? He was his moral conscience. We find in the miracles of Elisha, the disciple of Eliyahu, that the king of Israel comes to him in the midst of a terrible siege. And the king, who is a pagan and who has brought the Jewish people to paganism and who has arrested and killed the prophets of God, and he comes to the prophet and the prophet doesn't turn him away. The prophet doesn't say, you know, he's my palm, whatever. Get him out. prophet tells him, oh yeah, you know, you're going to be saved, but not because of you. You should realize that. The prophets were the conscience of the Jewish people. As long as the Nevi'im were there, then no matter how bad it was, it still wasn't bad. Because there was a force for good. And the force for good had such power to it. And had such an influence upon the people that in an instant they could turn them around. That's the great story that we have of Eliyahu and the prophets of the Baal. Eliyahu himself testifies that in his lifetime there only were 7,000 Jews that did not kneel to the Baal and did not kiss it. You're not saying that he's got 7,000 guys in the Kollel or 7,000 Shomer Shabbos. He has 7,000 Jews that didn't worship the Baal out of a population probably of 1 million, if not more. How do you like them odds? And he says, Vani nisharti levadi novi l'Hashem. There were so many prophets, and Achav killed them all out. I'm the only one that's left. I'm old and tired and broken. And yet he has the power in his confrontation with the prophets of the Baal, with the false prophets. He turns the Jewish people over. Vayomru Hashemu Elokim, Hashemu Elokim. The Lord is God. Eliyahu, you're right. That's the power of moral conscience. That was the secret of the Nevi'im. And that was the greatness of the Nevi'im. So now in the third idea of how the Nevi'im affected this period of Jewish history, I'd like to mention to you a few things that the rabbis tell us in the Talmud. Insights. Because it's necessary. In order to understand history, you have to understand the people. You have to have the insights. You have to see it the way the Jewish people see it. And Jewish history cannot be studied from the outside in. It has to be studied from the inside out. From the outside in, it's just one big, bloody, gory mess that makes no sense. From the op-ed pages of the Times, you know, we all got to pack up and move to Alaska or somewhere. Alaska is still too close. The Falkland Islands, if Mrs. Thatcher will sell it to us. But you have to see it from the inside out. From the inside out, it's a different world. Completely different world. Just amazing. I once heard that. I was in the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. I like that for name dropping. And I was in the room with the Rembrandts. There are 42 Rembrandts hanging in one room. Probably the most beautiful room in the world. And I was too cheap to pay for the tour, but there was a tour there, and the guy was lecturing. So I listened. And he said such a remarkable thing about Rembrandt that has really changed my perception every time I look at a Rembrandt. He said, a Rembrandt has to be seen, he said, from the inside out, not from the outside in. He said, look at where the light is. Start looking there, and then all of a sudden you'll see all the details. It will all flow from there. He said, you don't look at the whole picture. You have to look at a little where the light is coming from. And if you see it where the light is coming from, all of a sudden you'll see the whole pattern, the whole detail of the picture. And I was eternally grateful to him because he gave me a new facet, a new dimension on how to see it. Because if you'll go home and look at your Rembrandt, you'll see that what I'm saying is exactly correct. Well, Lahavdil, the same thing is true of Jewish history. The story of the Jewish, you have to see it from the inside out. You can't see it from the outside in. And from the inside out is the way the prophets saw it. And how do we know how the prophets saw it? Because we don't have any prophets today. So Chazal, in the Talmud, in the rabbinic literature, they conveyed to us that viewpoint. They gave us the key to see things from the inside out, to see things Jewishly. Our rabbis make a blanket statement. They say that a person who is angry cannot be a prophet. Our rabbis say that every time in the Chumash that we see that Moshe Rabbeinu became angry, and the Rambam has a long discussion of this in the Mor Nevuchim and the Guide to the Perplexed, every time Moshe was angry, he got punished, he got into trouble. Anger belies prophecy. Now, we like to think of the prophets as angry people. Again, that's our image. Right? The prophet Jeremiah, Amos, Hosea, Yeshaya, I mean, they're telling off the people of Israel. So they've got tremendous anger in them. That's not true. If they had anger, then they would not be a prophet. The prophets prophesied in love and in compassion, not in anger. And love and compassion sometimes allows you to tell somebody something that you won't tell to a stranger, to somebody you don't care about. You'll tell a member of your family that he or she is dressed improperly, or that the item doesn't go, or that you forgot to button the shirt, or whatever. But you won't walk up to a stranger in the street and do so. You don't tell them that this beautiful tie doesn't match the suit. None of your business. Why do I care? The prophets cared about the Jewish people. They cared about them so much that they told them everything. They weren't embarrassed to tell them anything. And whenever, the rabbis told us, whenever God, Yochel, felt that the prophets overstepped it, God doesn't allow them to be angry. God doesn't allow them to insult the Jewish people. God doesn't allow them to complain regarding the Jewish people. Not to God, at least. You got problems with the Jewish people, tell it to them, not to me. That's God's attitude. No complaints. In heaven, there really is no, there's no lost and found, and there's no return bureau, and there's no complaint bureau. Those are all inventions on earth. The Novi Yeshayo says, Besoch am tmeis vasayim monochi yoshev. I dwell amongst a people that is unholy. God immediately burns his lips. Don't say that. They are not allowed to say that. Don't say it in heaven. You have a complaint, tell them. And he tells us plenty to Novi Yeshayo. I mean, there's no juxtaposition of words that equals the prophecies in the book of Isaiah. But it's told to the people. If in the moment it's told to the people, then it's love. But if you complain to somebody else, that's not love, you know. Somebody, I want to come talk to you about your cousin. So that means that I can't, for some reason or other, I can't speak to your cousin. If I can't speak to your cousin, then I probably shouldn't speak about him either. In one single time, four great prophets functioned at one time. And that is from about the year 3100 before the Common Era. I'm sorry, for 3100 from creation till about the year 3300, for those 200 years. For those 200 years, which would correspond in our dates from about the time of 785 before the Common Era to about close to 600 before the Common Era. In that period of time, there were four great prophets: the prophet Hosea, Yeshayahu, Amos, and Micha. Our rabbis tell us the prophet Hosea, Tchilas Dvar Hashem b'Hosea. Hosea was the first, and in certain respects, the greatest. Hosea was a prophet in the northern kingdom. Amos was a prophet in the northern kingdom. Yeshaya and Micha together were in Judah, though they prophesied for everyone. And according to many opinions, Micha was the Rebbe of Yeshaya. you find many of the same exact psukim verbatim in the Navi Micha and in the Navi Yeshaya. It's not that they copied from one another, but they had, because of the fact that they had this close and intimate relationship, so they were influenced by each other. They had the same style. They had the same prophecy. And they were the core of the prophets. And they were the ones that attempted to stem the tide that engulfed the Jews in the first temple. The tide was idolatry. The tide was immorality. The tide was assimilation amongst the nations that surrounded them, the imitation of the non-Jewish world. And they attempted, as no one else did, to hold the Jewish people back. They were able to do so for a few hundred years, but eventually all the prophecies of the Navi Yirmiyahu, who foresaw the Churban, and who foresaw that the Jewish people would be unable to change quickly enough, that their fate was sealed by their own behavior. Prophets have different styles. In the words of the rabbis, Kol Novi Misnabe Besignono. Every prophet has his own literary style. And we see that from prophet to prophet. The prophecy is from God. How to put the words together, how to phrase it, how to have the style that was given to the individual. That's the difference between Chumash and between prophecy, between the Nevi'im. The Chumash is a direct dictation, so to speak, from God. That's why in Chumash every letter can be given over to explanation and interpretation. We can build halacha on an extra letter, on an extra word, on a phrase. You can't do that in prophecy because of the fact that the prophet is expressing his own literary style. And every prophet was different. Our rabbis give us the famous difference between the prophet Yechezkel, the Novi Yechezkel, and the Novi Yeshayahu. The Novi Yechezkel in the first chapter describes his opening vision, his first vision of prophecy. And it is described in tremendous detail. He describes the heavenly beasts and the chariots and the electricity and the fire and the entire scene. We read it as the Haftorah of the first day of Shavuos. And it's a tremendous, awe-inspiring Haftorah because of this gift of description. He describes everything. The Novi Yeshayahu, in the sixth chapter, when he describes his first encounter, so to speak, with prophecy, with God. So he says it in a few words. He said, and I saw God sitting, Kaviochel, in this great throne room, in the great castle, in the great building, and his presence filled the entire room, and then he continues, and he goes on. So our rabbis say, do not make the mistake to think that the prophet Yechezkel saw more than the prophet Yeshaya, because his description is so much more. There's such an insight here, tremendous insight. A rabbi say that the Novi Yechezkel, Dome Leben Kfar Sheroes Amelech. He's like a villager, a peasant, the first time he comes to the big city. The first time he sees the king, so he goes back home and he says, and I saw horses and uniforms and I this and that, and there were so many people that can't believe it, right? Sometimes if you stand in Manhattan and you see visitors from out of town, you can always recognize them because they say, please. Sometimes you see people that are from you know, and they're just a gawk. The buildings and the people and the noise and they just the whole thing, New York. Whereas the New Yorker who lives here all the time, or somebody who comes from London or Paris or another great metropolis or Tokyo, so he's less agog. Yeshaya Dome Leben Krach, our rabbi say. Yeshaya's the big city boy. He's hung around in heaven before. He doesn't have to tell you all of that description. What an insight.
into the nature of prophecy, into the nature of people. And that therefore every prophet has something to say, and he has to say it in his own way, in his own fashion, and he's the one that communicates it to us. And we have to see it in those terms. Our rabbis go further. Our rabbis say regarding prophets that they are the moral conscience of the Jewish people. So our rabbis say that from the time, there are two opinions there, but one of the opinions that I'm going to quote, the Talmud says that from the time that prophecy was eliminated from the Jewish people, there were no more prophets, then the gift of prophecy was given, the words of the rabbis are, litinokos, to children, lishotim, and to those who are not sane. They are our prophets. There are two insights here. One insight is the line between sanity and insanity is very thin. In fact, the closer a person is to genius or having creative ability, the closer he is to that line. And it is not... It's not unique, for instance, that Van Gogh or others were clinically insane and they were great artists, and because there's a little of that. The person that is 100% realistic, because that's our definition of sanity. Our definition of sanity is someone that's in touch with the reality as we define reality. Someone that's insane, he hears voices, he sees visions, he's operating in his own world. We say he's out of it. To him, his world is real. But because his world doesn't coincide with our world, so then we say he's insane. You see many times, Nebuch, on the streets, especially in large cities, people walk around collecting bags. You know, they live out of shopping bags. There are people that talk to themselves. There are people that see all sorts of things. I was in the city not long ago, and a guy stopped me. He said, you see that? You know, like it took me 10 seconds to realize that he's out of his mind. Because I started to look, you know, and I thought he's showing me something. A very thin line between reality and therefore between sane and insane. Insane is what society defines as being unreal. But in terms of absolute reality, it's hard to know what's real and what isn't real. We may all be insane. He may really be seeing something. It may really be there. Now, when prophets, when Nevi'im experienced prophecy, so they went into a trance. There was a physical suspension of ordinary bodily functions. It was like a catatonic trance. And that was the power of prophecy. And when it passed, so then they remembered the prophecy. But they were not, during the moments of prophecy, they were not in contact with reality. They were in contact with an ultimate reality, with a different reality. Not with the ordinary reality that we deal with every day. And therefore, it's not hard to imagine the rabbi saying that the gift of prophecy was given to those who are not sane. Because the sane people have lost the ability to deal with a different reality than the one that we're accustomed to. And to be a spiritual person, there has to be a certain amount of unreality within us. Not only just being impractical and naive, but a certain amount of unreality within us. Because if everything is only real, so then one can never achieve. One can never live outside of himself. One can never have dreams or accomplishments. It's not real. Part of the great tragedy of the baggage of Western civilization in our era is that we have reduced everything to such terms of reality that it destroys us. I'll give you a bad example, but I like it. I always mention it in the yeshiva. I grew up at a time when, thank God, there was no television. There was no television. So for entertainment, we had something called radio. Now today, there's nothing called radio, because today radio is news and music and whatever, but it's not radio. When I grew up, radio, if you heard a play or a story or a comedy hour on radio, it was what you imagined it to be. You were a participant. You weren't just a listener. You participated in it. It was an exercise in your use of your imagination, of projecting a different reality. We used to hear a ball game, right? So you imagine the whole ball game. Today, you see it, right? That's you can't imagine anything different than what your eyes show you. And that relationship to unreality, to imagination, that was part of a gift that's close to the gift of prophecy. That's the dimension of being able to live outside of oneself. In our time, you can't do that. In our time, there is almost no imagination left. Everything is explicit. Everything is graphic. Everything is portrayed for you. There are no illusions. There are no metaphors. That's it. You see it. And therefore, a little of our spirit has died with it, because that's how we measure things. So when the rabbis say that it went to those who were insane, or it went to children, because children are the ultimate unreal, right? Children still have within themselves the ability to capture what is unreal, and to them it's real. Whether it be their fears, or their hopes, or their games. My son was a very little child, so he had a toy car. And the car, in one of our moves, I think from Chicago to Miami, or maybe in Chicago itself, we moved a number of times, the car broke. And the only thing that survived was the wheel. Well, for 3-4 years, he drove around with the wheel in the house. He was driving all over the world. And to him, it was real. He was having the grandest time in the world with that little wheel. Only a child can do that. That's one of the gifts that God invests in children. So if our rabbis wanted us to understand a little of the nature of prophecy, so they phrased it in that fashion. There has to be a little of that unreality. There has to be a little of the child. There has to be a little of the person that's not quite sane, that's not quite committed to our reality. Those people, by the way, also had great spiritual qualities. And they were the conscience, and they were able to do all of these things, because they were not rooted in the same reality that the king was rooted in. They saw the world differently. They saw their role differently. And therefore, they were able to fulfill it. Our rabbis, again, in their description, compare three prophets. They said the prophet Jeremiah, the prophet Yirmiyahu, Tova kovod o'ov v'kovod abein. He was able to combine the requisite of demanding honor for the father, meaning honor for the Rabboni Shel Olam, as well as defending the Jewish people, because we find in the Novi Yirmiyahu some of the greatest prophecies of comfort, consolation. The great Haftorah that we read on the second day Rosh Hashanah, from the Novi Yirmiyahu, in which he portrays our mother Rachel weeping for her children. And he portrays the restoration of the Jewish people and of the land of Israel, and the day of the great shofar, the day of the great trumpet sound of humanity. So Yirmiyahu was able to combine in himself both. It's interesting how the rabbis chose him, because again, we think of him as the prophet of gloom and doom, right? In English, there's a word, a Jeremiah, which is a dirge. It's always something, sad. And if you see all the portraits of the prophet Jeremiah, the greatest being that of Rembrandt again, the entire troubles of the Jewish people and of humanity are poured out on his face. You see it in him. But that's only seeing half of him. And he had such a painful life, and he was arrested and put in the dungeon. And unfortunately, he lived to see all of his prophecies come true. Sometimes a person, there are people who prophesy and they have glee when their prophecy occurs, is fulfilled. There are people who belong to the I told you so club. And they're happy to see themselves vindicated, even at the expense of the other person's pain, even if the other person is a close person to them. Because their ego is such that they had to be right. But that's not the Novi Yirmiyahu. The Novi Yirmiyahu is not happy at all. He lives to see it, but he's not happy. But the Novi Yirmiyahu had the balance, our rabbis say, between Kovod Av and Kovod Aben, between the honor, so to speak, of God and the honor of the Jewish people. He saw it clearly. Now, rabbis say, Eliyahu, the prophet Elijah, Tova Kovod Av, he saw God's honor. Kano Kinesi Lashem Tzvokos, I am zealous for the Lord of hosts. He was, as I mentioned before, he's fire and brimstone. He's the kanoi, the zealot for God. Velo tova kovod aben. And he did not justify the Jewish people. He didn't look to pour any soothing oil on the wounds of the Jewish people. He left them writhing in their misery. We couldn't say it. Chazal say it, though. And therefore, in Jewish tradition, the prophet Elijah, God sends him to every bris. Because God says, you said there weren't going to be a Jewish people, and you said they were no good, and you said they weren't going to last. You know, you go ahead, you go to every bris, see, the Jewish people live in their blood. Omar loch b'damayeh chayi, Elio malach habris. That's, so to speak, his sentence. And Elio comes to tell us, Hinei Anochi Shaleach Lachem Es Elio Hanovi, I send the great prophet Elijah before the day of redemption, before the day of judgment, he will come to restore the Jewish people, to bind the generations together, to bind the Jewish people together. That's his penance, so to speak. And then our rabbis say, regarding one of the great enigmas amongst the prophets, the prophet Jonah, Yonah tovet kovet abein velo kovet oav. A rabbi, that's based upon the words that the rabbis tell us. The prophet Yonah flees. God tells him, go to Nineveh and prophesy. He flees. He quits. He got lost on the way to the store. He never ran the errand. How could a man, we're talking here about a Novi. Where is he going? He doesn't know that God can get him on the boat. So our rabbis say he mounted a protest to God. And he said, listen, I know I'll go to Nineveh. You know, like Billy Graham, Lahavdil, right? Everybody will stand up and say hallelujah, and they'll all repent, and they'll all put money in the coffers, right? A month later, it'll be just where it was. But it'll be the biggest revival meeting you ever saw. You never saw a revival meeting among Jews, did you? The reason is it doesn't work. You can give the greatest inspirational speech, etc. Nobody's going to roll on the floor for you. So he said, the Goyim are close to Tshuva. I know that the Goyim are close to Tshuva. I know the non-Jewish world, you can move it, right? They're affected by it. Jewish people, hard customers. Well, if you get them, then you got something, but it's hard to get them. And so what will happen is I'll go to Nineveh, and Nineveh will listen to what I say, and they'll repent, and we're going to look bad. The Jewish people are going to look terrible, because you've sent them prophet upon prophet, admonition upon admonition, lesson upon lesson, and they ignore it. And here you're sending me to Nineveh. In one speech, I'm going to come and say, Arboim Yom Od Nineveh Ne'epeches. In 40 days, Nineveh's overturned. They're all going to say, oh no, you know, that's it. We give up all our sins. So therefore he ran away. He was so concerned about the Jewish people that he lost the perspective regarding the Father, regarding the Rabboni Shalom. So God has to teach him that again. God has to teach him, you know, that you don't worry about it. Right? Don't figure it out. The people are always wiser than God, and they always are more religious than God. You know, God is not religious enough for many people. And God is too tolerant for some. You know, we have problems with God. He really doesn't behave himself. He's not in shape. So the Navi says, you know, so God says, you got a whole lesson with a fish that's going to swallow you, with a gourd. It'll take you a while, but you'll understand what I'm talking about, Yonah. You'll appreciate what's involved there. So you'll appreciate that my honor has to also be protected. But in those words, the rabbis described for us the task of the prophet. The task of the prophet was to represent God and man, to represent God and the Jewish people, to do a service for both, not to see them in an adversary relationship, not to say, I'm on God's side and not on the Jew's side, or I'm on the Jew's side, I'm not on God's side. And the prophet, therefore, had to have that unique ability to walk that fine line, to be that great person. That's why we don't have a surplus of prophets among the Jewish people. And our rabbis say that prophecy was restricted to the land of Israel. There's one opinion in the rabbis that when the Beis HaMikdash existed, to a great extent it was restricted in the area of the Beis HaMikdash itself, because it's a gift of God. It's a holy gift of God. And therefore, that it's operable only in holy places upon holy people. It's not the ability to predict whether the market's going to go up tomorrow or not. Or it's not the ability to predict who's going to win the election. Or even to predict what great events are going to happen in world history in the forthcoming decade. Those are all marvelous gifts, but that's not what a Navi was about. A Navi was a far greater dimension. So if we understand that background regarding the Nevi'im, we'll understand a little more about the story in Tanakh now, regarding the two kingdoms and what happened to them, and how they ultimately destroyed themselves, but the people survived. The monarchies collapsed, the temple was burned, the institutions were destroyed, but the people survived. The people survived because of the Torah and because of the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im who were the bearers of the Torah. They are in the chain of tradition of the Torah. Moshe kibel Torah m'Sinai, Mesora l'Yoshua, Yeshua l'Skenim, Skenim l'Nevi'im. The Nevi'im are the ones that brought the Torah to us. The Nevi'im are the ones that brought the Torah viewpoint of life to us, the national life of the Jewish people, and therefore that's why they're so important in this study of Jewish history.